and welcome to The Hub on RN, online and through the ABC Listener app. My name's Eddie Ayres. As you go to work today, maybe you're on your morning walk or maybe sitting in the morning light listening to the birds sing, how aware are you of your surroundings? Do you feel how the city or the trees or the rain is somehow changing you? And if you are in the city, maybe you're walking through one of the main squares or over a bridge, are you walking past one of those big concrete bollards that seem to be multiplying in our cities? And how do these seemingly small additions affect your deeper mood? Well, today on The Hub, you'll go into a whole city of bollards. You'll also be taken on a trip to Western Sydney for the Biennale and hear about possible futures for our museums with a conference called Museum Next. It's The Hub on Art, your seeing ear on the ABC. I lived in Kabul for a year back in 2016. I was teaching music there. Now, Kabul used to be such a beautiful city. It had wide boulevards, these elegant tree-lined streets. You can check out photos of Kabul in the 1960s online. Now, that city was long gone after the Civil War, and the boulevards had now been colonized by these concrete blank bollards. Bollards upon bollards, until you were lucky to be able to squeeze your car through them. So I came back to live here in beautiful, calm, war-free Australia, and I was surprised to see these first tiny seeds of a bollard city here in Brisbane. And I have to admit, I had little flashbacks of that constant deep fear I'd had when I was living in Kabul. So how many bollards did you see on your way to work today? And how did they make you feel? Because it's easy, isn't it, to sort of underestimate how our surroundings are actually influencing our behaviour. Now, if you go to our Facebook page, it's the ABC RN The Hub. You can leave your comments there on that very question. But right now, for her latest exhibition, the Georgian-born artist Nina Sanadze is focusing on this new feature in our cities. The exhibition is called Bollard City, and it's on at Melbourne's Living Museum of the West until the 25th of March. And Nina is joining me from Melbourne. Nina, thank you so much.
Thank you, Eddie.
Nina, what do bollards represent to you?
To me, I have very kind of personal history that that comes up when I see bollards. And like you, I have seen the war in Georgia in 91. As a teenager, I lived through a civil war post-Soviet breakup in Georgia. And that brings back memories of street fights and the bollards that I've seen there, and makes me kind of feel uneasy and fearful, I guess. It's a signal to worry about impending danger. But also, inadvertently, I think that they are a symbol of tragedy and lives lost and what happened on Bourke Street and other places around the world.
Now, Nina, these bollards are here for a reason, aren't they? I mean, there were these terrible, terrible tragedies that happened in Melbourne of the cars running into people and killing so many people. So the argument is that they are keeping us safe.
Yes, they're functionally perhaps necessary in some places. However, I'm interested what they symbolise apart from the idea of protecting you. I think inadvertently, they do function as symbols for other things. And this is what I'm interested to think about. They're symbols for what happened, and they're symbols of war on terror, I guess.
That, yeah. When did you first come to Australia?
96.
And when did you notice bollards coming into our cities?
Well, I didn't notice them until after Bourke Street terror that we had, they appeared suddenly half a year after. And when I walked into them, literally, I did have an absolutely shocking sort of reaction. I was shaken, and I felt that somehow after feeling here very safe for years, I felt that was a real transition for me into a place of anxiety, and where I as an artist, I had to respond. And I had to I started doing art on bollards on the street, but then I realized that, you know, decorating them on the street, what we're doing, we're making them more friendly and familiar, and they eventually start disappearing from our attention.
Yes, Nina, I was just checking out your website, actually, and if you're listening here, then you can go to Nina's website, which is a beautiful site. So, Nina, Sanadze, S-A-N-A, DZD, you'll find links on our webpage as well, .com. And then there's these pictures of Nina's selected projects. And I see, Nina, that you have done a lot of work with bollards. The Concrete Knowledge exhibition from, was that last year? Is a very interesting exhibition.
Yes, it is. Concrete Knowledge, Concrete Knowledge has the, it's on the street. That's the quotes that are collaborated with fantastic Melbourne artist Julie Shields, and we put quotes from thinkers and philosophers about ideas of freedom, and the quotes are along the line of injustice anyway is a threat to justice everywhere, from Martin Luther King, or by Amartya Sen, responsibility requires freedom. To be free and to act are the same, by Hannah Arendt. So these ideas we put out on bollards around the city because they directly refer to bollards rather than using them as an empty space to paint on.
Nina, did you notice with your own reaction to bollards, because of your own history of having grown up with war in Georgia, did you think that your reaction was quite different from people who perhaps have grown up here in Australia?
Yes, definitely. I had a lot of discussions, and everyone had a different reaction. Some people hardly noticed them,
yes,
and others thought there were seats and things like that, or other people felt they're really good for safety. And so there was quite a variety, and they told me that is my exaggerated reaction, you know, because of my exposure to war. However, a lot of people also thought that they do create perhaps this place where the racial vilification can be stirred, and, you know, people who think about them more, it is a place where it can be, civil liberties could be eroded, and, you know, our freedoms can be constrained. And we talk a lot with friends about public spaces. What should they represent?
Yes.
Should they be free and open, or should they be, you know, covered with bollards? And this change is happening quite slowly, but they're spreading around St Kilda now, around in Melbourne, in lots of places, and a lot of investment going into the bollards.
Nina, tell me about this current exhibition, City of Bollards. How did you use bollards in the exhibition?
So when you first walk into the space, you're led through the zigzagging passage, reminiscent of the bollards in the airports, and there is the only point, the only reason I did that to make people feel somewhat controlled in the way they walk, I guess how in some spaces movement feel like in the airports, and then they are released into a big space, and then they have to go downstairs, and that's where they see the main exhibition, which consists of 30 concrete bollard shapes. And the shapes, these bollards are actually replicas of Anditera barriers from London Bridge, from Martin Place in Sydney, Christmas Market in Berlin, Bourke Street in Melbourne, where the reaction of the government was to immediately put those concrete barricades. And
did you make the bollards out of concrete as well? I mean, I know originally they would have been in concrete, but are they now the replicas?
Yes, so they look like they're concrete, but they're sort of quite light. And there is that question that people ask, are they light, are they heavy? And so it is a surreal place, it's not a real place, but putting them together, these amazing shapes, they're sort of spheres and rectangles, and they're all together, they form the landscape that I'm hoping to create the evocative emotional resonance in people walking through them.
Yes. In what sort of way? Can you be more specific?
I'm hoping that, to make people feel and to think about ideas of safety or danger. Is this order or is this disorder? Is it place of freedom or control? Is this safety or danger? And, you know, the questions, are they real bollards? Are they true or false? You know, and these are questions that are they real? Are they surreal in a way? Is this landscape real? And the place itself sort of reminds me of more of a storage facility where these bollards could be stored after something happened, or they could be stored there because we're waiting for something to happen. It's quite open to interpretation. It could be a demolition site, a cemetery, or could be actually a city itself. In that way, I want people to think about where are they and where do we live? And I was really interested to create replicas of bollards and bring them into the gallery space rather than continuing doing art on them in the city, because by bringing these powerful symbols that we have now on the streets into gallery space, it creates the conversation that I'm interested in.
So basically it's sort of getting people to open their eyes to see how important how sort of profoundly important really something so simple is, in a way.
So I'm practically turning them into sculptures, and you know, that's quite significant, because once they're utilitarian and functional as if in the city, now they're in the gallery, they're object of art and something to mortalize them and to remember them as these symbols of what happened and where we live, our times, to what do they represent, how to reflect our time at the moment.
Yes, well, we certainly don't want our cities here in Australia ending up looking like Kabul. So it's great that it's great that you're bringing people's attention to it. Thank you so much, Nina. Nina Sanadze and her exhibition Bollard City is on at Melbourne's Living Museum of the West until the 25th of March. So it's quite a short exhibition. So I hope that you'll be able to go along to that. And if you go onto Facebook, you'll also see our post about bollards and how they make you feel. So Hop has said on Facebook, they're a constant reminder of the ugliness of the circumstances that lead to their requirement. It's true, isn't it, Hop, that, you know, that terrible list of the events that Nina just read out. And Hop goes on to say, if we have to have them, could they come in some other shape? What if they were animals? We could at least turn a horrible necessity into something that shows how we can respond in spite of it. And Gilly has also commented, I don't feel scared, I'm just disappointed that they are generally pretty daggy. Gilly, that is so true. An opportunity wasted. So thank you so much for your thoughts and thanks for getting in touch. You can join our conversation now by heading to the Hub Facebook page. We're ABC RN The Hub, and you can also follow us and like us while you're there.
You're listening to The Hub
on Art
with Eddie Ayres.
For this year's Biennale of Sydney, the artistic director Mami Katoaka has commissioned 56 original works. And one of them is a video installation by Japanese artist and theatre maker Akira Takayama. So Mami took Akira on a tour of Western Sydney 2 years ago, and he was inspired by the mix of cultures he saw there and also by Kabuki theatre. It's that ancient form of Japanese theatre known for its really spectacular staging and performance, and also for not really a lot happening. Anyway, Claudia Taranto checked out the project.
A woman in a black dress stands spotlit on the stage of the Sydney Town Hall. She's nervous as she looks out at rows of empty seats, and then she starts to sing in Hebrew. She's being filmed for Akira Takayama's video installation, Our Songs, the Sydney Kabuki Project.
The artist, Akira, from Japan, took us into the town hall and showed us the empty room. And he asked us to imagine all our ancestors sitting in the town hall in the audience and sing to them. And when I was up on the stage and it was my turn to go in, I was a little nervous. But suddenly I got a flash in front of me of my dad, Richard, sitting in the audience right in front of me and beaming up at me. And it gave me a real lift. And I was actually able to sing to him and bring warmth and love to him. And it really made me quite emotional singing that day.
Ella Dreyfus was one of the 76 people singing a song or reciting a poem that day in the Sydney Town Hall. And the result is a video installation that's a rich tapestry of folk songs, prayers, mantras, pop songs, poems learned at school and around the dinner table in 42 different languages. Michaela Tai is the director of 4A Centre for Contemporary Art in Sydney's Chinatown, where the artwork's on show.
Akira's work is really great, and it's been particularly intimate and personal experience for all of us working on it, because it began as an idea that he had when he came to the city, and walking through the streets here in Parramatta and all around, just seeing all the different languages and sort of allowing that to wash over him, and his response then to think about the idea of kabuki theatre as an act of discussion or appeasement from one group or one class to another really helped him come to this idea of how can we create discussion or talk about a bigger idea of who Sydney is and the different sort of cultures or languages or stories that are intertwined. And that sort of marrying that with the idea of kabuki seemed to be this sort of kind of perfect way to describe this, really this giant ode to Sydney.
Each performer had to walk down a long, raised walkway to get to the stage. It's called the Hanamichi in Kabuki. Here's Akira Takayama.
Each person comes to Sydney Town Hall and we set the Hanamichi, which means runway in Japanese, but it's a special word for Kabuki theatre.
It looks like a fashion catwalk.
Yes, but the meaning is different, because the Kabuki Theatre is used to be a street performance, and they, you know, paraded or they played performance on the street. So that is a trace of that origin. So I set Hanamichi to come and to go, because Kabuki Theatre was invented by immigrant people.
Marrying Kabuki with its immigrant roots and Sydney's diverse cultural mix has resulted in a poetic 5-hour video of the performances. They're heartfelt, funny, and some of them are very emotional.
Jhulate gokule chandra hindode Jhulavat sab braj nari
Hey oy oy le hey oy loy la Hey oy yo le loy loy la
So so mo gi lo mo lo jim mo lo lo mo lo ju gai gao mo lo ju cha go si so yi yo mo mai ju 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 cha ju fan de han pok pok.
Each person and each idiosyncrasy of each voice and each walk really comes across. And some people sing with their mothers, some people support their mothers when they sing. There's children, there's costumes, there's crying. It's really quite beautiful.
Town Hall is the place for, you know, citizens. And every different person, you know, could appear as citizen. And that was the point I really found important.
That's why you chose the Town Hall?
Yes, yes, yes.
There was a lot of excitement at the opening last Friday. Everyone was keen to see their own and each other's performances.
My name is Victor Valdez, from Mexico, originally. When I sing this song, it made me feel very nostalgic. And when I'm singing, I can see the land, is the traditions, the food, the smell, the flowers, the rivers. So many things come to my mind when I'm singing. They made me a little bit sad, but happy at the same time.
And they did it to an empty town hall, so the seats were all empty. Yeah. Why?
Okay, I'm from Japan, and theater is a bit like a ritual. So it's not only for the living, but also for the dead, and I believe that too. So I set the chairs, like full of chairs, but it's empty. And in our imagination, it's empty, but the dead could be there.
My name is Marcel Mansour. I am a visual artist, writer, poet, and my background is from Palestine. I was born in Gaza, Palestine. I've been here for 40 years in Sydney. So I chose the song of famous Fairuz. Fairuz, she's a big phenomenon singer, and she was born in Palestine, but she was raised and grew in Lebanon. So she's a Lebanese artist, and her voice is so beautiful. So she sung a lot of songs about Jerusalem, and this is one of them. It just tells the people about Palestine. It's a peace, it's land, it's holy land. So it's got to be respected around the world, and to give the rights to her people, just her own people. So I thought to read this poetry, and I got really excited while I was performing this poem, and I just I sang some of the verses in the middle of it. But what happened at that time, on Friday, just 1.5 days before, my sister in overseas in Gaza, she just passed away. And I was very, very sad about it. And I was very sad. I said, how am I going to perform? And Akira said to me, listen, as you know, there is no audience in the town hall, and all these chairs, empty chairs, presenting dead people. We talk to dead people, our ancestors who passed away, and that's why I dedicate this poem to my sister who passed away at that time.
Uno, due, tre, la gallina al caffè, al caffè il cioccolato, la gallina è malato di dolore, la gallina.
And do you have a song or poem from your ancestral past?
We've been asking this to each other in the office because we've been, you know, it's really interesting to hear all these different ones. And one of our highlights was singing Happy Birthday in Chinese. Both me and my colleague Michael remember that very clearly from when we were young. But also I think there's some songs that are made up in families that I think would have been nice. And my father used to always sing crazy songs about food and how I need to wait and not eat so fast. So I probably would have sung something like that. And there's been quite a few personal songs that are in the show.
So I imagine people who come and see the show perhaps will be inspired to sing their own ancestral songs.
Yeah, I think everyone has been talking about what would they sing. I've heard that, and each week we're inviting different performers to come back and share some of their food and talk about their stories and encourage others to talk as well. So it's going to be a really great few months for us.
Claudia Taranto with that story. Thank you so much, Claudia. And now the ABC invited some of those performers that you just heard from our songs into the studio to record the songs and also tell the stories behind them. So you will be able to hear those on Life Matters over the next couple of months, starting with one tomorrow, in fact. And you can also catch the video at 4A Gallery in Haymarket in Sydney, and that's on until mid-June. Graffiti artists fighting for their rights. Tracy Emin's birds arrive in Sydney. Banned cycling numbats in Perth. It's got to be arts news.
What else?
Edwina Stott, my producer, and hang on a minute, arts news purveyor. Where did you get that title from?
It's self-appointed, but totally credible. So if you could not question it, that'd be great.
All right. Thank you so much. Edwina Stott, arts purveyor. Arts news purveyor. So what's been happening?
So the big news today is happening in Sydney. Acclaimed British artist Tracy Emin has spent the morning perching almost 70 life-size bronze birds on lampposts, awnings, windowsills along the streets of Sydney CBD.
Wow.
How wonderful. So the trail of birds is going to stretch down Grosvenor Street and Bridge Street, and they're going to culminate at a large stone bird bath in Macquarie Place Park, which is inscribed with the name of the artwork. It's called The Distance of Your Heart.
Oh my gosh, that's making me cry inside. Obviously, I won't cry on radio. Why birds?
Well, she's spoken briefly about why she chose birds, and here's a little of what she had to say.
I've been drawing birds for a long time. maybe 25 years. I did ornithology when I was at school, and I really genuinely love birds. I said that they're angels of this earth. The Distance of Your Heart came about with the idea of literally of migration and looking at something which is beautiful in the city. And the city's big, the city's massive, but the bird's small, tiny, delicate, fragile, like we are as human beings. Public sculpture can be about something really delicate and intimate and special. I would never just apply to any old city to do this project. It made sense for me to do it here. I know that when people first see them, they'll think they're real. And I also know that people will touch the birds as well. And this actually feels really nice to hold.
That's British artist Tracy M in there. And she spoke as part of a video to promote the installation, which is being revealed today.
Yeah.
So she was among 700 artists who pitched for the city's public art initiative. Her work cost $912,000 and was made from 2 tons of bronze and took 4 years to complete.
Wow. Now, look, I know this brings this beautiful subject a little bit down to earth, but I am a bit worried about the birds being nicked.
Perhaps we should raise that with them. I think they'll probably secure them fairly.
I know they're not going to sort of be propped up yeah. like we did with our rental art here.
Yes.
Just, you know, propping it up.
Yeah, yeah. We didn't feel the need to super glue it to the easel.
No, that's right. And nobody nicked that, actually. So Tracy Emin should be good.
Yeah, I think that's a fair analysis.
Yeah.
So she hopes that the permanent public artwork will slow life down for a moment for people in Sydney. And she also wanted to address Australia's distance from the rest of the world. She asked herself, how do you express the feeling of loneliness without words? And she decided that she could do this in the form of a bird, lonely, modest in scale, and in the way birds are thoughtful looking almost.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's a really beautiful
Although,
piece.
Again, slightly playing devil's advocate.
Here we go.
Okay, we're not a long way from Indonesia. We're not a long way from New Zealand. And we're not a long way from ourselves. So what about people, first of all, who are indigenous to the country?
This is true.
And also people who were born here and you know, many generations Australians.
I think this is an artwork that's quite personal to her too. She describes seeing backpackers taking their photograph next to a post which described how far away Sydney was from all these other cities. And she thought that that was quite sad. She said that the words, the distance of your heart, she inscribed them in the large stone bird bath in Macquarie Place, and she hoped that this was a place to be photographed.
Yes.
To let the people you love know you're missing them. And she says that in today's age of technology, it's easy to send an image of where you are and what you're doing, but it's very hard to send a message of how you're actually feeling.
Yeah, it is. Look, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, life does get pretty slow in Sydney if you're in a car and in traffic.
And just a side note, we're hoping to have a little bit of Tracy Emin on the show next week too.
Excellent. All right. Edwina, Arts News Purveyor. H&M. Hang on a minute. H&M.
Yes.
In trouble with a graffiti artist. Remind me who H&M is.
They're the big global fashion retailers known for fast fashion. So they featured a photograph and video of a model backflipping off a graffitied wall in a recent ad campaign. And the street artist whose work was featured is a Los Angeles-based artist called Jason Revoke Williams. He recognised the design as one of his own creations. And so in January, his lawyer sent a cease and desist letter asking for H&M to refrain from infringing on his copyrighted work. So this is a really interesting case because it raised the question, does a mural that was painted illegally in a public park deserve the safeguards of a federal copyright law?
So this is going back to one of those arts news stories from a few weeks ago.
Yeah, we spoke about Five Points and that
landmark
case, which featured those former warehouses in Queens that became a street art mecca, and following a long dispute with the owner of the building, they were bulldozed.
Yeah.
In short, they were awarded a huge amounts of compensation for their work being demolished. But this one, after a backlash of people crying out against H&M trying to take over graffiti artists' work, and they actually they filed the lawsuit against Williams, claiming that the product of an illegal act could not be protected by copyright. But after that backlash, H&M issued a statement which said it was never our intention to set a precedent concerning public art or to influence the debate on the legality of street art. As a result, we can confirm that we have withdrawn the complaint filed in court.
Ah, very good. Now, this artist, he's got a little bit of a history as well, though, hasn't he?
He has, yes. He has taken on a fashion designer in the past when they used some of his images in their fashion, and that was settled out of court as well. So he has had a history of taking on people, but he's just protecting his art.
Well, it's true, and graffiti art does seem to have, you know, building up quite
a growing movement. And
yeah,
on the
right.
graffiti art note, Banksy has made a return to New York City with a few new murals in the city after 5 years. Haters,
does anybody know who Banksy is yet?
I don't think so. I think there's speculation.
Hang on a minute, you could be Banksy. No, you were here yesterday.
But how can I be Banksy and an art news purveyor?
That's a good point. It's a cover, that's all. Okay, and James Brennan, he's won this year's Baldacci Prize.
Yes, the Baldacci Prize is, of course, the Archibald's Prize satirical cousin, well known for its satirical depictions of well-known Australians.
Yeah.
And yesterday they announced James Brennan as its 25th winner, marking the fourth time he's won the 10 grand prize money.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow, who did he paint?
He painted fellow artist and comedian Arne Doe, and it depicted Arne painting a caricature of himself.
And finally, were you going to say something else?
Oh, just that the exhibition of the Baldacci Prize finalists will be held at the Sofitel Sydney Darling Harbour from the 20th of March to the 22nd of April.
Excellent. They're always very entertaining, those things. And Tony Abbott always seems to turn up somehow in his budgie smugglers. It's like every year.
Well, if you will put yourself out there like
That's a good point. Hey, so finally, Perth Cycle Art, what?
Yeah, well, as a cyclist yourself, I thought you might be interested a Perth cycling group, which last year delighted the internet by drawing a goat on the city's map, has followed it up with the emblem of Western Australia, the numbat, which is, of course, endangered.
So just explain how this actually happens on the app.
They use Strava, which is an app for runners and cyclists to track their routes.
And it draws your route on the map, doesn't it?
Yes.
As you cycle it or as you run it,
for instance. And so they cycled the outline of a numbat.
Oh, that's so clever.
And eventually on the app, they had the picture of the numbat. And it was mapped out first with a lot of Perth's northern suburbs features. But to get the hind legs right, apparently they had to cross the river. And it covered 192.2 kilometres and took 6 hours and 33 minutes to complete.
Oh, that's a big ride. Now, Edwina, you're a runner. You go for a run at lunchtime. So what animal are you going to run this lunchtime? You could run a small one.
I think I could probably achieve a worm, or if I'm really ambitious, I think probably a very wiggly snake. What do you think?
I think that sounds good. Now, final thing, you owe me $8.
Oh, no, for the jokes. Oh, dear.
If you don't want me to tell you a joke, you've got to give me $8.
Well,
come on, cough up.
All right, fine. I'll take a joke if you've got one.
All right. What did the artist draw before she went to bed?
I don't know.
The curtains.
Oh, dear. Oh, there it is. You had to go and do that, didn't you? It was all going so well up until then.
$8. That's two coffees. No, probably one and a half these days. That was producer and self-appointed arts news purveyor, Edwina Stott. Edwina, see you again next week after you run.
Hi, I'm Claire Wright. Shooting the Past is back in 2018 for another fascinating look at Australia's past through remarkable, intriguing photographs. And this time round, we want to include your happy snaps. Do you have a photograph in your family album that you'd like to share? A bush Christmas or that photo of your grandpa working on the snowy scheme? Send us your photograph now. Just look for the Shooting the Past tile on the RN homepage.
There's nothing like a little bit of an old mixed in with new. I think, is that Celtic fiddle playing and maybe mixed in with something like dubstep? Maybe a little bit like going to a museum. Well, there's nothing like a visit to a museum, is there? It can be a mind-changing, exhilarating thing, or it could leave you wishing you'd just stayed home to binge-watch the Santa Clarita Diet. But these museum peeps are onto it. Museums, that is, not the binge-watching. And Museum Next is a global community with regular conferences to discuss the future of, well, museums. A couple of the speakers at the current Brisbane conference are Teddy Asher, PhD. Teddy is the neuroscience researcher at the Peabody Essex Museum, that's PEM, in Salem, Massachusetts, in the US. And Teddy is the first neuroscientist on staff ever at an art museum. Teddy, welcome. And we also have David Perkins, who is an experienced developer in with Museums Victoria. David has been working in museums and science centres for about 12 years. David, wonderful to have you here.
Hi, good morning.
So, David, what is a museum?
Oh, that's a big question.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, one of the glam sector. It's an institution, you know, a public institution where we keep old things and people come and learn about things. Is that like a short answer?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I suppose museums are just in our psyche in some sort of way. But I just wondered, you know, how often do you question then what is a museum? Teddy?
All the time.
Okay.
Well, no. I mean, I should say I'm new to museums.
Yes.
And so I've only ever, before this position, I had only ever experienced them as a visitor. Yeah. And so it's been a really interesting experience to consider what a museum is from kind of the other side. And what is a museum?
What role do you think a museum plays in our societies?
Well, I'll fall back on the mission statement of our museum, which is to create experiences that transform people's lives by broadening their perspectives of themselves and the wider world. So I think, at least in the mentality that I'm developing, a museum really just serves as a place of exploration and pushing horizons.
Yeah, I think they really help people understand their place in the world and sort of help bring a bit of understanding to that world and, you know, sort of see where we might be going and see where we might have come from. And,
absolutely.
Really, they're sort of places where people can learn about themselves and history and science. Yeah.
Do you think a successful museum mirrors a successful society? I'm starting with the easy questions, guys.
Oh, boy.
Really weighing in there. I don't think so. There's lots of different museums around the world and, you know, we're all still trying to figure out what's the best way to do it. And that's, I guess, the nature of information and technology and all of that changes our role in, like, helping people access that or helping people, you know, find out these stories or learn or engage with each other begins to change as well.
Yeah, I would say more than mirroring, I think there's this interaction between society and museums. In which, you know, museums are constantly considering what the society needs, and I think the society then has the opportunity to react to what the museum does and shows. And so there's this constant dialogue, I think.
Now, David, you started your career in customer service. That seems like a great place to start a museum career.
Actually, it was cleaning the tables in the cafe.
Oh, was it really? Yeah. So what did you learn from your early days about the sort of psychology of people in museum visits?
It's kind of great, you know, when you start, I guess, in the cafe or on the floor, you spend a lot of time with the actual visitors and you see how people behave and how people visit a museum. You know, you get lots of different types of visitors. You get ones who come in families or you get people who are on dates or, you know, school groups, which are a whole other thing. And just when you spend different times in different parts of the museum, you really begin to see it from all these different angles.
Mm. Is that something then that people, as they progress in with their careers in museums, that perhaps they might not do quite as much, in fact, spend time actually inside the museum?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think we can all be a bit guilty of not going into the galleries enough, you know, because we've got work to do, we've got things to do, exhibitions to create, programs to make. So maybe you don't go down and spend time with the visitors so often.
Yeah. Now, Teddy, you're the first neuroscientist in the world to work that we know of to work full time in an art museum. So, what's your remit when you got this gig?
My remit?
Yeah. Like, what were you given specifically to do?
I see. It wasn't very specific, actually, and it took us all, I think, a while to figure out what exactly it was that we wanted to do. But the end objective really is to improve the visitor experience, to create better exhibitions, whatever that means, and to do that by allowing findings from the field of neuroscience to inform the design of experiences with art in a museum setting. So that was sort of the description that I was given, but it took a little while to figure out what that meant practically.
And?
Okay. So what we've come up with is this three-phased approach where in the first phase, we sort of delve into the neuroscience literature and look for findings that are relevant to designing exhibitions or that could be relevant to designing exhibitions. We then formulate a hypothesis about how to apply those findings to the design of an exhibition. Then we do just that. We implement that hypothesis using various interpretation and design elements.
Can you give me an example?
Well, we haven't completed this process yet.
Yeah.
But what we're working on right now is basically the background research that informs our work right now stems from the work of a psychologist in the 1960s named Alfred Jarbis. And what he observed is that the purpose with which you look at something, your viewing goal, impacts how you look at it and therefore what you see. And so what we're toying around with right now and what we're actually about to study in a kind of formal experiment is whether giving visitors a viewing task or a viewing goal can help them to engage with the artwork by modulating how they look at the artwork.
Ah, now is this something that you're aware of, David, in your work with Museum Victoria?
Yeah, it's actually, so I've been working on an exhibition that's about to open called Beyond Perception at ScienceWorks, and we're making it for teenagers. So as part of that, we've spent 2 hours every month with the audience to try and co-develop it in a way that it works for that audience. So hearing the neuroscientist's point of view of like how they're using the science behind people's motivations or why people might, you know, act in a certain way in the gallery, you know, and we're sort of going from the other end of like spending time with the audience and seeing how they behave and how we can change the experiences and the interpretation to work for them. Sort of, it's nice to, you know, it's really great to hear Teddy talk about such a structured and sort of scientific approach to it. Yeah,
and this is one of the reasons for this particular conference, isn't it? That you guys, you'll give talks, but you also all get together and share ideas and I guess network.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's really nice to like talk to other museum people. Yeah. You know, you don't get so much, you know, in your daily life, meet very many people who actually work at a museum. So you come to this place and suddenly everyone's like passionate about what they do and they want to talk shop and talk about things they've done and things they've learned and like different ways that things are working, or, you know.
Yes. Do you think that a successful museum necessarily takes a lot of money?
I think we're both looking at each other.
I think it makes it easier.
Yes.
I mean, I know that in the work that I've been doing, I've been asking for a lot of money.
Oh, okay.
Just, you know, for equipment or to collaborate with various companies that provide services that could be useful to us. But I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's necessary.
Yeah.
I think it facilitates.
Yeah.
But
it can help, you know, because there's so many researchers and scientists and historians, and it all costs a lot of money to keep things, you know, working, to keep all of the objects at the right temperature,
yeah,
and to keep the stores functioning and things. But I think the best museums in the world are free, and people use them in a different way when they're free, because they just lounge around, you know, they go several times, you know, a week or a month, you know, or they just use it as a place to catch up with, you know, their mums and bubs groups and things, and it really becomes a sort of place for a meeting place in society.
Yeah, now, David, I know that you're specialising in, at the moment, developing stuff for teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
What is it specifically that you've discovered that teenagers are perhaps react to more within an exhibition?
They really don't like a long interpretation, and that's sort of one of the main things we found out. I think, you know, they've grown up in a world with Spotify and YouTube and things, and
yeah,
just get information so quickly that the way I process information is very slow compared to them. We showed them one video that was 4 minutes long and they were really agonizing over how long it was. 4 minutes.
That's shocking. Is that something that you've discovered as well, Teddy?
Excuse me. You know, I haven't had as much direct interaction with visitors yet, so I'm not sure. but from what I hear from my colleagues, yeah, there's a limited attention span, and you know, you don't want your labels to be too long and things of that nature.
Yeah. Now, guys, speaking of short, unfortunately, we've only got about a minute left of this interview, which just has gone ridiculously quickly. The museums that we'll be going to in, let's say, 20 years, David, what are we going to going to be seeing, do you think?
Oh, I think they'll be very similar to the museums we have now, but the way we have the information, access information might be different, you know. We might have no labels at all. Do you know, you just access it all through some sort of AR kit or something like that. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that the essence of the museum visit probably won't change, but that the methods might change. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio. I know you've got a super busy week with this Museum Next conference, so thank you very, very much. And I'm really excited to come and see the exhibitions that you're working on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Teddy Asher, PhD, and Teddy's the neuroscience researcher at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts in the US. And David Perkins, experienced developer, Museums Victoria, and they're both here for the Museum Next conference in Brisbane. So what sort of good or bad museum experiences have you had? You can check out our Facebook page and post your story there. You're with The Hub on Art here on RN. I'm Eddie Ayres, and it's time now for Top Shelf. Today we're meeting the Australian Indigenous artist Adam Hill, better known as Black Douglas. He makes amazing paintings in a sort of pop art style. Black's also a musician, and here he is talking about some of his all-time favourite artists.
Hi, I'm Black Douglas. I'm an artist from Western Sydney. I'm a Koori. My old people come from Jerseyville and Kempsey, we're Nungadi. And the other old people from my mother's side of the family come from Ireland. I've been making art for 20 years now, and migrated in from Penrith, from Western Sydney, where I was raised, and now I practice in Redfern. And I'm looking back at the transitional period and I guess what has shaped me as an artist and to what I paint about today. So it's quite an interesting life that has evolved in an illustrious way, and I'm going to talk a bit about music and artists who have shaped my making. Interesting thing, being Aboriginal in a kind of fairly white bread community where, as with most adolescents, you're seeking for identity, and particularly when it's not a massive Aboriginal population in your area, you kind of have this yearning for blackness. And so, interestingly, all of my musical influences in the early days, we're talking the 80s and 90s, were black musicians from America. And I think back to my first LP. My first LP was Are You Experienced by Jimi Hendrix. And I was particularly drawn to the amazing cover art of that primarily. And then back in the days where you went and hunted your LPs in music stores, of course, I was generally honing in on really amazing illustrated covers. And so Bob Marley, and I think of Confrontation, the album, and the beautiful illustration of him with his flowing locks and whatever. Give thanks and praises to the moon sky. Give thanks and praises so high. And then the first CD, and I had this amazing portable CD player, and it was probably one of the first ones around. And I remember the very first CD was the double album Musicarium by Stevie Wonder. And it was incredibly expensive to buy a CD back then. It's like $70 or something. You saved up all of your hard-earned money from working in Franklin's and bought that CD to fit in my portable music player. And I just thought I was just the bee's knees, you know. And then on to hip-hop, Grandmaster Flash. And these guys were constantly in my record collection. And so it's just a weird kind of association with a Western Sydney Koori boy. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Being influenced in art began with watching my mother's brothers. They were famed, what they called coach painters back in the time, and otherwise known as sign writers. And so this was an amazing art form that sadly died out in most places because of the advent of vinyl cut lettering. So I watched them go through that transition period, and watching them produce amazing airbrush work and hand-brushed work on everything from semi-trailers to speedboats. It was back in the 80s when people had lots of money, and the Americans would send their speedboats out from America for the Brown Brothers to paint these things. And so I watched them and learned the art of using the brush, and then was the kind of the grand master of our family, Don Evans. And my uncle Don Evans, he was responsible for the War Memorial, the embattlement scenes at the War Memorial in Canberra, little kind of diorama models. And so he became so famous in our family because he met the Queen when she visited and to inspect this kind of work. So I grew up watching these and become influenced by my uncles making that kind of work. But when I think of Aboriginal association in art back at the time, it was incredibly cliche to say that it was Namajira. And your nana or your some family member always had one of those little Namajira prints in the house. So that generally was our only association to Aboriginal art. We weren't big art goers and visiting galleries per se.
If you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea.
Later on, I'd be really blessed to be on a position at the Australian Museum up the road, and I befriended an Aboriginal artist who was employed to create a maze of paintings through the Indigenous Australians exhibition. And that was Kevin Butler, a beautiful Aboriginal artist from Wollongong. And he became a big major influence on my initial wantings to become an artist, because I just thought it was so cool to be paid to come and sit in an artist's studio and create works for something, particularly when you live somewhere else like Wollongong. And so it's so exotic to travel up to make work, and I thought, I want to do that one day. And so I still note him as one of my favourite artists and mentors. And from there, it just started to blossom. You know, being involved in that exhibition put me in touch with all types of art and different mobs from around the continent. And so that's remained a passion from the so-called tribal origins of art to what I am today as a modern Indigenous artist.
The Australian Indigenous artist Adam Hill, who's better known as Black Douglas, talking about some of his favourite artists for Top Shelf. And it's so great that Western Sydney is having such a big shout-out on the Hub on Art today. Well, that's it for the show. Thank you to everyone who's contacted us on Facebook today. And remember, you can post your comments about our Bollard story there. And the Facebook is ABCRN's The Hub. And if you'd like to help people find our show, then you can give us a 5-star rating on Apple iTunes, if that's where you actually subscribe to the Hub on Art. Deborah wrote in on Facebook and said, "The concrete bollards are as ugly as all get out. Can't we achieve the same result but with better looking barriers? Flower beds, for example." Deborah, that's a great idea. And they actually even did that in Kabul outside the US Embassy there. The bollards are also flower beds. It was kind of beautiful. That's it. Thank you so much for joining me. Bye-bye.